Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hello and welcome to the Midweek Takeaway North Sea Oil and Gas Special. Today we're joined by a select panel of industry experts to mull over the current investment in North Sea oil and gas and more homegrown energy, the proposed windfall tax, very controversial, and our dependence on Russian gas and decisions to phase out Russian oil imports, plus the current energy price hikes, which are crippling both the public and businesses whilst oil majors report record profits. So without further ado, I guess I'll allow the guests to introduce themselves, starting with you, Steve.
Right. Hello. So I'm Steve Brown. I'm CEO of Orcadian Energy. If you haven't heard of us, we have a development project in the central North Sea called the Pilot Oil Field. It's a viscous oil field, 80 million barrels recoverable. And those have been audited by Sproul. So we've got a mark of endorsement there from them. We're out in the market looking for partners to develop this oil field. And I think developing oil fields is what the UK needs to get going. So,
hi, guys. Yeah, I'm Malky, and I write a blog, which is what most people know me for, although I've been a consultant in the oil and gas business for a long time. I started at Wood Mackenzie, actually, 40-odd years ago, in August 1979, and I've been in the oil industry ever since. Obviously, I write an independent blog which reflects, you know, differing views than you might get in the oil industry in general, and that reaches out to a lot of retail investors who were disenfranchised by the EU when MiFID II came in and effectively stopped investment banks and brokers writing research and putting it out in the traditional way. So that's what I do.
And I'm Mike Cooper, MD for Trove for Subservice. We're a consultancy that has one of the largest energy databases available. It's a technical database with mainly subsurface and infrastructure information. Probably best known for our YouTube channel, which you can find by just Googling Trove Oil and Gas, and you'll find that we do lots and lots of videos. They're all educational about all aspects of the UK and many, many other countries around the world.
Excellent. Thanks for the introductions. So I guess the first question is, does the North Sea oil and gas sector need more investments in new developments, as clearly Britain will need domestic fossil fuel resources? Starting with you, Malky.
The word you use correctly with fossil fuels, and the point here is that over the last 3 or 4 years only, we've been in this process where a lot of the people on the renewable side of the business think that that we can transfer from oil and gas to fully renewable in no time at all. And I've been writing for about 3 years that my contacts, particularly in the Middle East, but also in the other major producing areas, have been realizing that for many years, we're not going to be able to get away from the fossil fuel problem, if that's what you want to call it. I think the only way to make it realistic is what people are doing in using the word transition, and, you know, and making sure that if you've got what is considered to be a dirty oil field in the North Sea, maybe old, maybe an existing platform, is you have to make sure that the operator moves it into a net zero carbon situation, which Steve will be able to explain much more than me. But the point is, fossil fuels are here to stay for some considerable time, and where we do it is down to the oil industry. But I would say transition, move to gas and a net zero and carbon free, if at all possible. We've already seen it in some fields in the North Sea, which are, you know, electrically powered and virtually zero carbon already. So that's my first starter for 10.
Yeah. So actually, I'll refer to an article I saw on Energy Voice this morning, where Simon Roddy, the head of Shell in the UK, was saying, you know, we really do have to invest in developments in the North Sea. He was referring to a decline in recent years that was 15% per annum. If we, you know, if the oil production in the UK declines at 15% per annum, it'll be no time before it's gone. And the only way you stop that is by investing in new developments. And actually, there's a raft of very good projects out there ready to go. There's the Rosebank project. Equinor submitted their environmental statement just recently. That's a 300 million barrel project in deep water. There's Cambo. Cambo will be back. The protesters won't have to rewrite any new signs, but Cambo will go this time. There's Clare South, there's Isabella, and then there's actually three projects in the hands of small companies that are all looking for partners. So there's the Buchan project that Jersey have, there's the pilot project that we have, and the Perth project that Parkmead have. And, you know, we need all of these projects to be developed. This is the point. We need all of the above. We need all the wind we can get. We need all the solar we can get, and we need all the oil and gas we can get. And one of the reasons we need new developments in the North Sea is new developments can, as Malky was saying, be much cleaner than old developments. You know, there are some platforms in the North Sea where the emissions per barrel produced are up around 100 kilograms of CO2 per barrel. And it's because they've been producing for years. They're just, you know, it's 95% water cut. The oil's dribbling out. You're putting lots of energy in to get the oil out. A new development like our pilot field can be 2.6 kilograms of CO2 per barrel, you know, right down there, right down there. And what the activists miss when they say just stop oil and so on is if you don't refresh the production base, all you're left with is that old high emissions production. So it's absolutely consistent to be investing in new developments, and the UK needs it more than anyone.
Yeah, I mean, I concur with both Malky and Steve that, you know, fossil fuels are going to be a part of the energy mix all the way through to a transition to net zero. It is going to take time, probably decades. And, you know, what we really need to see is greater efficiency. Now, if we can develop our own indigenous resources, you know, from the North Sea, from onshore, from wherever it might be, and Steve mentioned a number of projects which really should be looked long and hard at and could be economic and brought forward. But, you know, if we don't do that, what we're going to see is we're going to see greater pressure, more imports, and essentially the carbon footprint actually is going to rise. Now, last year, there wasn't a single onshore well drilled. Offshore, we're at an all-time low for exploration drilling. Exploration is the start of the cycle. We start with exploration, then we appraise our discoveries, and then when they reach a point of maturity, we can then sanction them and put them onto production. Now, very few projects have come forward in the last few years. The declining production is a great concern. And whilst we totally support, and as a consultancy, we look at, you know, geothermal, at wind, at solar, at all sorts of alternative or renewable energy sources. We need oil and gas, and we need it all the time.
There's one other point, actually, and we might as well get it out in the open straight away because it's been going on for a very long time. Is that, and government policy has got a lot to be blamed for all this, over 30 years. The gas storage is the simplest thing you ever did see. Now, people like me get data from the States into my inbox every week. Every single week of the year, it says how many, during the winter, how many therms we've taken out, of the storage, and in the summer, how many therms we've put into storage. So it is perfectly possible. It's very simple. We have fields in the southern North Sea, which are empty, and we have exactly the same seasonal pattern, as we're about to find out. And only in recent weeks have they said they might just let the Rough field start up again. It is absolutely common sense. It's a no-brainer. I know we're not in the North Sea. It's a bit like saying, don't let the county councils make the decisions about Planning Commission for onshore oil and gas in the UK. But this is an even easier one. And it was taken away because people weren't prepared to guarantee the gas prices for the longer term. And we now know how stupid that was, but we can now guarantee gas prices. And I bet Steve is absolutely totally in agreement. But in terms of guaranteeing gas prices, you can afford politically and profitably to store gas in the southern North Sea.
Yeah, you've got that huge, is it Harland and Wolff situation in Island McGee in Northern Ireland? They have the ability to store huge amounts of gas now. And obviously it's been passed now, I think, but You know, they need to get on and be doing those things, I would imagine.
And you've got a pipeline between Ireland and the UK.
Why not? It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, Mark is absolutely right. The lack of gas storage in the UK, it's actually criminal. It's just, it's crazy that we got ourselves in this position that Rough was allowed to shut down. It was insane. The trouble is it takes long-term thinking. And, you know, I'm not one to criticise governments because that's not good for your
health. No, go on. The politicians are thinking about the next vote.
We've got a whole hour on 10 trust. 10 years ahead.
So, you know, politicians tend not to be able to do the long-term thinking because it takes an awful lot more capital to get energy from a renewable system than it does from oil and gas. The IEA published a chart showing how they needed this to have this big ramp up in investment in renewables. And they showed next to it, you know, a chart showing oil and gas investment, but they did them on completely different scales.
I'll come on and ask you a question in a minute about the tax and what's happening in the UK. But interestingly, about this renewable situation that we've all mentioned, obviously, in terms of transition or movement to it. But does anybody honestly believe that we have the structures in place to build this many electric cars? We don't have the lithium. We don't have the copper, probably. We don't have the graphite, you know, for these lithium ion batteries. We don't have any of that stuff. And I'm not just talking about the UK here. I'm talking about the world. We probably don't have the steel because we don't have enough metallurgical coal to create the steel from the iron ore. So how is this going to happen? I mean, have any of you got any views on that? Malachi, what do you think?
My guess would be that by the time we get to being able to produce an electric car with a battery that you can lift out of it, the electric car will have gone by then. It'll be something different. And the point is, we just haven't realised that, you know, how many different things people not get told about electric cars. First of all, you know, we all know how difficult it is to find somewhere to fill up. Second thing is that you can't go below 20% and you can't fill up above 80%. You don't know that 40% of the pickup trucks on the UK motorways, if the battery is over the tyre that is broken, they can't lift it up. They have to tow it away. How many people know that, you know, in terms of the value? I mean, they're very expensive at the moment, even with various subsidies. But when it comes to a few years' time, if you have an old car, it's fixable, even to an extent of a worked-over engine. You go in a battery car, they'll say there's a new battery, and that'll be another £28,000, please. You know, there are so many things that that are working against electricity for vehicles that... You know, and there are plenty of good things. And, you know, if you've got a family who are doing a school run in local streets in Birmingham or wherever it happens to be, you can plug it in every night and it'll do you 50 miles every day and so on. But as Steve said, this is such renewables is still such a small proportion and an expensive proportion of the way we use energy. It's, you know, we're just people pulling the wool over the eyes, you know.
You know, huge developments with offshore wind and the recent ScotWind awards. But what we've got to look to is the actual infrastructure, the cabling within the UK. Is it sufficient to actually take? Certainly, there aren't any major cables up to the northern points of Scotland to actually gather this. So there's a huge infrastructure investment has to be made. There's great opportunity. I mean, the UK is one of the leading offshore wind producers, and more developments ongoing. We're producing gigawatts of power offshore, and that is just going to grow exponentially over the coming decade, which is fantastic news. But we also have demand is growing all the time for energy, and whether it's electricity, you know, how can we generate it? Wind and solar, we all know they are intermittent. We haven't really got the battery storage. Oil and gas, you know, a gas generating turbine, that's the sort of thing that can deliver short-term power. We don't have too much potential for hydro. Geothermal's in its infancy and producing next to nothing. We've got to look all across the board to everything, but at the end of the day, oil and gas are going to underpin the UK energy supply for decades to come.
Yeah, yeah. And Mike, those peaking stations you talked about to level out the grid, they need gas.
Yeah.
So it's like even because of the scenario that we don't get enough wind or we don't get enough solar or we don't get enough whatever.
Well, we're phasing out coal.
We still need the gas.
Yeah. We're phasing out coal. That coal will be gone by 2025. Nuclear, we've got an awful lot of reactors that are coming to the end of their design life. We know that the new reactors are still a decade away before they're going to be operational, and they always seem to move to the right. So there is investment, there are plans afoot, there is an energy policy, but you know, for now, we desperately need to keep oil and gas delivery to basically keep the country supplied.
Yeah, the best analogy is that somebody switched the light on, but then forgot to tell anybody that it needs electricity. You know,
take it back to square one, Kevin, because there ain't no kids being taught at school what the difference is between fossil fuels and the fuels of the future. There's no one being told what the difference is between coal and oil and gas and the transition that will be to gas. More importantly, actually, when it comes down to it, first of all, on the coal front, I think we're still going to see coal for much longer than people think, and certainly in various parts of the world. I've just come back from Houston, where I was meeting with a guy who lends money to oil and gas installations in the Gulf of Mexico. Yeah, actually, he said a quarter of my business is actually now lending money to people who are building coal plants still in the US, and so coal ain't going anywhere for the time being. But the final point on that front is talking about kids and education and everything else is these guys think that electricity comes out the wall.
Yeah. You
know? And it's
your does, Matt. It does. What are you talking about? It does.
And they walk, they watch the telly and they see these people lying down on motorways saying, get rid of oil. And they've got an iPad in their hand. They've got a phone in their pocket. You know, they get home in the evening and they plug in the iPod or the iPad or whatever it's called nowadays, the phone, the whole band. And the electricity from the wall, which is made by sometimes oil, usually gas, is just ready to get them ready for another demo tomorrow.
Yeah, it's the same as the Wi-Fi. Where does the Wi-Fi come from? Yes. It's the same thing. We couldn't be having this conversation without probably gas and powered, and my AC wouldn't be working without Egyptian gas. It's just the same thing, you know. It's the same scenario. Yeah, we don't believe it. It's like, where my children, I've had to explain to my children where the meat comes from, even like, because yes. Kids don't quite understand where the cow that they're eating comes from, or the chicken or whatever, you know. So it's the same scenario.
Yeah, my daughter the other day, a little while ago, said, you know, go on, Dad, I know you're only defending this because you're in the oil and gas business and you're old, but actually, I took her into the bathroom and I said, right, let's count how many things were made by oil or a byproduct of oil. And when we got to 30, she came in and sloped off down the stairs.
Right, right. I don't know if you saw it, but Ed Conway and Sky did a really nice piece on the Humber refinery, the Phillips 66 Humber refinery, where they make anode-grade coke from heavy oil from the North Sea. And where does the anode-grade coke go? It gets shipped to China to be put in anodes in batteries for electric vehicles. So, you know, oil gets used for lots more than just putting a match to it or a spark plug.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, we're talking about storage batteries are required for all of these things as well. Yeah. So we can produce these things, but we're going to need the vanadium to produce, you know, the storage batteries.
Yeah, vanadium,
if we don't have that vanadium redox to do the storage batteries, we need the graphite for the lithium ion batteries, etc., etc. And the world doesn't have these resources. You know, it's the same situation with oil and gas. So if you haven't got the oil and gas plays to have the oil and gas in place, you also don't have the ability to store the batteries because you don't have the raw materials. They don't exist.
Yeah.
So, or they do exist, but they're still in the ground, you know. So anyway, we've got another question. How is the windfall tax being viewed by the majors? And is there actually a tax incentive to these companies? Or is it just posturing by the beautiful Conservative government, which doesn't know which end is up at this moment in time, to appease the public whilst energy prices are all-time highs? Anybody remember, just before you answer that question, that oil actually went negative a year and a half ago?
I wrote about it, but I'd like Steve to go first on the test because he's the fount of all knowledge.
Oh, yeah. Okay, Steve. Give
us your wisdom.
I'm always willing to speak, you know. So, I mean, I look at the energy profits levy and I actually look at it and say, this is a pretty well constructed tax. If what you want to do is to make oil and gas companies that are producing lots of oil and gas in the North Sea put their hands in their pockets and kick off some development projects, because you know, nobody likes waking up on the morning of the 25th of May to see that Rishi has slapped another 25% tax on their profits. Nobody likes that. But he chucked in an extra clause, which was you don't just get 25% back on your energy profits levy payments. You get another 20% as a super deduction. And when you add up all the deductions, you know, before first oil in a new project, you get 75% back. Overall, you get 91.25% back. So he's changed the economics of an awful lot of these development projects in a pretty clever way. I think the industry will get there soon. I can see, you know, Equinor with their statements around Rosebank are recognizing that, you know, they won't pay any energy profits levy if they do the Rosebank project. They're only producing about 20,000 barrels a day from Mariner. But whatever energy profits levy is due will be offset by their investment in Rosebank. A lot of the industry has been going through what I call the five stages of grief. Or, you know, at first there was anger, then there was denial. They've been stuck in bargaining for a long time. They dragged Rishi Sunak up to Aberdeen, sent him away with his tail between his legs. I don't know who said that to a journalist, but they did. They should be shot for that. And they've been hoping that Liz Truss will throw the tax out the window. I don't think she will. I think, you know, the fuel price crisis means she needs some money to play with. So the $5 billion she's expecting to get this year from the energy profits levy, she can't give that back. It's just, it's not going to work. And eventually, you know, the industry will get through depression and acceptance. And when they get to acceptance, they'll realize, you know, we can avoid most of this tax bill if we do some of these development projects. But it's taken a while. And it makes sense to me that it takes a while because companies are having to shift their strategies. You know, so many of the companies that have been coming into the North Sea have had a very, very clever and sensible strategy, which is to buy production, hedge it, leverage their balance sheets, and wait for the commodity price and the interventions they do in the fields to deliver a result. And it's worked really, really well. They haven't really wanted to take development risk. Now there's a massive carrot hanging in front of them to take that development risk. So I'm an optimist that this energy profits levy will actually play out well in practice. I've even lobbied to improve it. I've said on the supplementary charge, give those rebates immediately. And that would make the upfront rebates even bigger. And I think in the long run, it'll spark a bit of a boom in the oil and gas sector in the UK. That's my hope. But, you know, maybe that's because I'm an optimist. I wouldn't be doing what I do if I wasn't an optimist.
I think that the problem is that the windfall tax is just another example of a tax that's been imposed. It introduces uncertainty for investors and for major companies. So $5 billion a year, that's the equivalent of probably just three large projects. Now, the same oil and gas companies are looking to fund and move into the renewables and fund offshore wind, to fund major solar developments, et cetera. Now, if all of a sudden, you know, they're finding that more of their cash flow is actually, or the profits are going in this windfall tax, then they're not going to be investing there. The other thing that we must bear in mind is that there's a big world out there. You can do business in just about any country. And right now, you know, places like Namibia and Guyana, West Africa, and the Far East, you know, these are places where there's lots of activity, and, you know, you would perhaps look to spend your oil and gas dollars in developments overseas. And unfortunately, the windfall tax doesn't really help that. It is okay if you're making profits, but for those companies and some of the ones you mentioned earlier, Steve, you know, that don't have cash flow, that don't have profits, there's no benefit. I mean, there's not really any incentive, because the rebate is retrospective. It's not going to be a cash handout up front, which is what you would like as an optimist, but unfortunately, it ain't going to happen.
No, I'm not hoping for that, Mike, because that would be hoping for too much. But, you know, what I am hoping for is that some of those producing companies look around in their portfolios, realize actually other people have the projects that are on the plate for the North Sea, and they come and farm in and take the projects forward.
Yeah.
Because all these projects, you know, Buchan, Pilot, Perth, they all need a lot of capital to happen. They're not trivial projects. They're actually projects of some real scale.
And do you know what? These oil companies started all on their own without any help from anybody else, because in the mid-2010s, they cut back capex to such a degree that production wasn't coming on in 21, 22, 23. You know, there was a trillion or more dollars that was taken out of capex because of the short-term nature of the way that the oil majors handle things. And you mentioned negative oil price of 18 months here. Sure, the February contract for West Texas expired in a negative, because Trafigura or one of the anyone would have done the same. The trading companies knew where the oil was, and they knew that where it couldn't get to. So it came, and the oil price went down to virtually nothing. And what happens? BP start by cutting everything in sight. They cut capex so much they effectively shut down their UK exploration department, and various other companies did it as well. So, yeah, I mean, they could easily explain themselves away by saying we've had over the last year some really bad years, but they don't. They're just like a pig in you-know-what. They roll around in all this money that they've made, and then they tell everybody about it, and they don't even explain. You know, I don't mind people saying, you know, never complain, never explain. But actually, if I saw anybody with any sense from either of the UK majors or some of the other people getting up on the soapbox and saying, this is how it happens, this is why we need it, this is how much it costs, and that's why when we have a good year, we shouldn't be taxed by the government, and that'd be fine. But Bernard Looney has said, you know, all the wrong things for 2 years. He's you know, he's awful. He's, you know, BP have gone through a period in the last 20 years, you know, ever since, you know, the stars in the sort of the late 80s, Messrs. Brown and Horton, ever since then. But you know, they could stop this themselves with a little bit of common sense, which they haven't got. So the Looney tax is what I call it, and that's because, you know, he's made so many comments, and then of course on the front page of the Sunday Times, you know, his 5 million plus own personal tax stuff comes into, and it gets worse. I think Steve is exactly right. If you use the tax right and you invest in the right way and you take the all of the bits and pieces that you're allowed to, fine. We wouldn't be in this state if the majors hadn't made, you know, huge mistakes in cutting back in capex when it was the wrong time of the cycle, and then, you know, saying how good they were right now, and they ain't any good.
Yeah, I mean, the scenario with the majors is surely they've got huge amounts of write-offs in tax to bring forward from the last number of years where they've had a horrible time. Well, I'm assuming anyway. I mean,
it doesn't work for the EPL. The EPL is really one of the games these companies like to play is to buy some production that's paying tax, buy some tax losses, put them together, and you've made some money. But you can't do that with the EPL. There's no allowance for losses in the past, no allowance for investment in the past. I mean, when Equinor, I think, first looked at it, and they were looking to get a 25% additional tax on Mariner, a project that they spent £7.7 billion on, or their partner spent £7.7 billion on, they must have been sick, because they invested a vast amount of capital, but were still going to be taxed on the marginal production. Actually, if they do Rosebank, they won't have to pay EPL. So they're kind of fine. But it's a very cleverly constructed tax.
Okay. The majors did the same thing, though. You know, we talked, the majors almost did the same thing as the politicians. No, they thought that going from oil and gas to renewables either could happen way too fast, or they sold the story to the investors that, you know, BP was going to become a green company, Shell was going to become gas orientated and a green company in such a short period of time that it was not feasible. Yeah, I mean, is that fair or not?
No, I think you're making a good point there, Kevin. You know, clearly the energy system is going to get greener with time, but there's a pace at which you can do things. And also there's a practicality to what you can do now. And, you know, the big companies, they've said they're going to go green, but we rely on those companies for an awful lot of our current production, and we need that production, and we need new investment in projects in the North Sea. You know, there's been a dearth of projects. I think there was one project approved last year.
So I guess it's almost like a rhetorical question. Are we over dependent on foreign energy? I think 4% is our reliance certainly on Russian gas. And what can be done in the short term to remedy this?
Obviously, the answer is yes. And we shouldn't, you know, I wouldn't have started from here. But the point is that we have to, you know, open up every opportunity we've got domestically, which won't be done straight away. And I know this is a North Sea discussion, but we should be talking onshore as well as offshore. We should be doing all the things that we need to in terms of storage and so on, as I mentioned. And then we have good relationships with a lot of the people who are in a position where they can actually, you know, supply us with oil and gas, primarily gas. We're talking about Norway here. We're talking about Qatar. We're talking about the US. And you know, we know around the world that there are people in a much worse position than we are. But yeah, it's a very difficult problem. It ain't going away quite yet. But there are a number of things that we can do straight away. And we have to just put our hand up and say we have to try fracking here and there under the normal safety regulations that they operate everywhere, or the safest regulations anywhere in the world. I don't mind. But in places like that, you could have whole cities being powered by domestic onshore gas.
Yeah, I mean, another area we haven't touched on is carbon capture. Now, not just from a domestic market point of view, but there is a huge amount of carbon dioxide generated, you know, on mainland Europe. And when you look at where the places are where you could actually store this carbon dioxide underground, then two countries come out, and that's the UK and Norway, where all the big offshore oil fields are. It's the same place, oil fields and gas fields. It's the same place where you're going to store lots of carbon dioxide. So there's a massive opportunity for the UK to grab there, and that helps to actually, you know, transition towards that to net zero, because we need to capture it and put it away, and that's how we can increase the efficiency for the entire industry and the Western world.
Well, Mike, before we started the conversation, I was very interested. I know it's not about the North Sea, but the issues that are going to arise in Saudi Arabia in terms of, you know, probably one of the world's biggest producers alongside Russia. I mean, you were talking about the fact that their oil supplies are there, but their production is likely to fall off a cliff. So what's going to happen?
Well, it was a prediction made in the early 2000s that there seemed to be some indications of some of the fields were in decline. Now, Saudi's reserves is basically a state secret. So there is insufficient information to make a technical evaluation of it. But what we do understand is for the last decade, they've been producing somewhere between 10 and 12 million barrels of oil per day from just Saudi Arabia. And that's not including all the other countries on the Arabian Peninsula. Twilight in the Desert is the book that Malky's holding up there, and absolutely a great prediction there. It didn't come true. I mean, they keep on producing, but what's happening is they're accelerating production. They're drilling more wells, they're drilling horizontal wells, they're debottlenecking plants, they're building more terminals, more pipelines, more refineries. This is all acceleration. How much incremental adds of reserves is going on? We don't know the answer to that, but if the decline starts, it'll be very, very difficult to arrest. And there is this potential that it will fall off a cliff at some stage. And we don't know when that might be.
Yeah, I suppose if you were Saudi Arabia and you had a copious amounts of oil, but you knew it wasn't going to last forever, and the oil price was $90 a barrel to $120 a barrel, what would you do?
Geopolitics within OPEC.
You wouldn't sell it all now for certain. You do what they're doing at the moment, keeping a number of barrels a day back. And, you know, what hasn't been mentioned in this whole palaver about Saudi in the summer is that in the old days, Saudi produced what they wanted, when they wanted, and domestic power for air conditioning and so on, they just didn't have it. Ever since the Arab Spring, domestically, you know, the Saudis allow their homes and offices and factories to be air conditioned. And I reckon that 1.5 million barrels a day that would go to export in Saudi Arabia during the summer months is used at home for domestic power. So I think they're saying nothing doing at the moment, but they could easily be hiding the fact that in September and October, November, December, they could produce more if need be. Mm. I would say that, you know, this is not meant to be a program where we have a discussion where we think the oil price is going or one way or the other. But I would say is that at the moment, the oil price has come $30 off for all the reasons of Iran and so on and so forth. But, you know, this is a very, very tight oil market, particularly if you believe Mike and the fact that the Saudis are going to go off the edge of a cliff at some stage. But it's a tight oil market at the moment. And a tight oil market when China are down because of COVID and they're not buying crude as much at the moment or producing, you know, any product. So the product market is tight, the oil market is tight. If all this recession chatter goes away, or it isn't as bad as people think, what would the oil price be if China comes back on stream full blast in terms of the economy? We're not talking 130. No way.
One thing that amazes me about Saudi is you've got the US, who were really didn't have great relationships with, was it the murder of Jamal Khashoggi? And then all of a sudden, since the issue with Russia and Ukraine, you've got the Biden's visit to Saudi palling up with them. It just shows you how fickle the whole world is in that sense, doesn't it?
Well, it's not just Sleepy Joe, for goodness sake. I mean, you know, before the election, he was the new green president that we were going to have. No more pipelines, no more federal leases, no more cutting deals with the Saudis. The Middle East policy from the Americans has been atrocious for a while, but it's a lot worse than it was under Trump at the moment. They've got no position where they've had to reopen the pipelines. They've had to announce more federal sites. The whole bank shoot, he's completely reversed it all over the price of a gallon of gasoline.
Why did Biden come in and shut the pipeline
up? Well, I think he just wanted to be the greenest president ever there was. Okay. And don't work like that.
Yeah, he should have just bought a costume and put it on. No, then you'd be green, you know. But this was bizarre because basically the US did have energy dependency during some of those Trump years, I think. It was producing enough. And then all of a sudden, no, I'm cancelling this pipeline and I'm making it more difficult. And now they need a lot more energy. It doesn't make any sense at all.
So they need more energy, and the UK needs more energy, and the UK needs more development projects happening. So, you know, what we need are two things. We need the companies that are producing oil and gas in the UK to look at the projects that are out there, are they ready to go? And actually, we need people in the City of London to stop pandering to the ESG activists and say, you know, we need investment in oil and gas, and let's put some money behind these projects. The whole country really needs a resurgence in investment in oil and gas. Otherwise, there'll be blackouts. Yeah. And
it'll be like Cairo, because my electric goes off on a fairly regular basis. But you guys in the UK, you don't get it. But, you know, my electric can go off whenever it fancies and maybe not come back for a few hours.
Yeah,
and, I can also go to Lebanon and I don't get electric for 23 hours a day, you know, and I have to have a generator. You know, we don't understand as UK citizens that actually, as Malky said earlier, that, you know, where does the electric come on when you switch that switch, you know, when you want your Wi-Fi, when you want to charge your iPad, when you want to, you know, go on your computer. We don't understand it. We think everything must be green, and we want it green, and we want it green now, not 20, 30 years' time, which we believe, I think all of us believe, even though you guys are heavily involved in oil and gas, you believe that we should have a greener planet. It makes sense. Yeah. You know, nobody's against this, but there is a transition period here that I think the politicians have thought, this is good capital, good political capital, can all be done in 5 years, it can all be done in 10 years, we'll put this in. It's not possible, absolutely physically impossible in every way, shape or form. So if we want to keep the lights on, then we've got to use oil and gas.
Correct.
Or fossil fuels, and it's as simple as that. And we have to use our own as well. And the Russian and Ukraine thing has really spelt that out in, you know, single syllables, that says you need to get your own fuel.
Well, I think we've put the world to right. We could probably talk until the cows come home about all these and debate all these issues. But Mike Cooper, Steve Brown and Malky, thanks very much for your time.
Pleasure. Nice to see you guys.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys. Come back and we'll sort out another world another time.
This podcast was brought to you by Roast PR Limited. If you would like to appear on a future episode of The Sunday Roast, please email admin@thesundayroast.net.